This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Tom Perata, is the author of the novels Election and Little Children, which were both adapted into films. His novel The Leftovers was adapted into the HBO series of the same name. HBO is now producing a pilot for a possible series based on Perata's latest novel, Mrs. Fletcher. The book, which is now out in paperback, is about major life transitions and the sexual transitions that accompany them. When the novel begins, Eve, a 46-year-old divorced single mother, is saying goodbye to her son Brendan, who's leaving for college. He expects college to be a big beer and pizza party with plenty of girls. He's unprepared for the way he'll be called out for his sexist behavior. Meanwhile, Eve, facing the freedom and loneliness of the empty nest, signs up for a community college class called Gender and Society, a Critical Perspective, which is taught by a trans woman. Although Eve's been worried about the influence of porn on how her son treats young women, she finds herself turning to porn and is surprised by how much she starts to like it. Terry spoke to Perata when Mrs. Fletcher was first published last July. A note to parents, although they'll be talking a little about how the main character becomes drawn to porn, they won't be talking explicitly about the porn she watches.
Tom Perata, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to ask you to start by reading from the very beginning of Mrs. Fletcher.
Okay. It was a long drive, and Eve cried most of the way home because the big day hadn't gone the way she'd hoped. Not that big days ever did. Birthdays, holidays, weddings, graduations, funerals. They were all too loaded with expectations, and the important people in her life rarely acted the way they were supposed to. Most of them didn't even seem to be working from the same script as she was, though maybe that said more about the important people in her life than it did about big days in general. Take today. All she'd wanted from the moment she opened her eyes in the morning was a chance to let Brendan know what was in her heart, to express all the love that had been building up over the summer, swelling to the point where she sometimes thought her chest would explode. It just seemed really important to say it out loud before he left, to share all the gratitude and pride she felt, not just for the wonderful person he was right now, but for the sweet little boy he'd been and the strong and decent man he would one day become. And she wanted to reassure him, too, to make it clear that she would be starting a new life just the same as he was and that it would be a great adventure for both of them. "Don't worry about me," she wanted to tell him. "You just study hard and have fun. I'll take care of myself." But that conversation never happened. Brendan had overslept. He'd been out late partying with his buddies. And when he finally dragged himself out of bed, he was useless. Too hungover to help with the last-minute packing or the loading of the van. It was just so irresponsible, leaving her with her bad back to lug his boxes and suitcases down the stairs in the sticky August heat, sweating through her good shirt while he sat in his boxers at the kitchen table, struggling with the childproof cap on a bottle of ibuprofen. But she managed to keep her irritation in check. She didn't want to spoil their last morning together with petty nagging, even if he deserved it. Going out on a sour note would have been a disservice to both of them.
That's Tom Perata reading from his new novel, Mrs. Fletcher. So I love that you have these two parallel transitions. Mother's transition, the single mother's transition, when her son is leaving for college, and his transition when he is the one who's leaving. And there's so many points in this book where I think he's being so oblivious to her needs. And I thought back to myself when I left for college. I wasn't thinking about my parents' needs. I didn't ask them, "How do you feel now that I'm leaving home?" It never would have occurred to me.
No, you assume they're all right. Their stories are set and you're the one who's on the adventure.
Exactly. And that's part of the point of your book. The mother's story is not set. Like, she's questioning who she is. She's questioning her sexual orientation. She's questioning what kind of life she wants to have, how she should shake up her life. She goes back to community college and takes a course on basically like sex and gender. So what got you thinking about these two parallel transitions the mothers and the sons and how you could kind of join them together?
Well, the first part of it is, I think, that I've been kind of tracking my own life in my fiction. So when my kids were little and on the playground, I wrote little children based on those experiences. And when they were playing sports in junior high and high school, that gave me some of the raw material for the abstinence teacher. And the most recent era of my life has been this transition to the empty nest and to this post-parental moment of reflection. Like, okay, this huge project of raising kids is over. What does my life look like now? What does her life look like as well? But I never really write straight autobiography, and it seemed like a much more poignant thing to reflect on what it would be like for a woman whose son was the other person in her family. She really is alone when he goes to school. The empty nest really is empty for her.
Well, another thing that really sets off the story, it's on that day that she's about to drive him to college for his first day there. The girlfriend who her son has broken up with comes over for a visit. So the mother, Eve, goes out to get gas before driving him to college. When she returns, she hears that they're engaged in a sexual act, and he's giving her son is giving his girlfriend, really his ex-girlfriend, these crude sexual commands about what to do to him, calling her the B word. And Eve is just like appalled. Like, she's an enlightened woman. Like, she hates this language. She hates everything it stands for. And she doesn't know how to have that conversation with him, and certainly doesn't want to have it with him on the day that they're parting, that he's going to college. But she wants him to begin college with the understanding that there's a difference between sexual relationships in real life and the soulless encounter he presumably watches on the internet. So what made you think about that? Does that come out of your life, too, of wanting to make sure that your children weren't learning crude, condescending ways of speaking to their boyfriend or girlfriend from either learning it from friends, from television, from porn, whatever?
Well, I just think it's a really interesting and peculiar moment in American culture because on the one hand, there is this kind of crudeness in the way that we talk. And on the other hand, there's this conflicting urge to really police the way that we speak. And so you see it with the B word, as you said. But so it's very common to hear women laughingly refer to their friends with that word. But then there's a sense that, a guy should never say it to a woman. And you might say, well, that's a clear rule, but it's also a confusing rule, and I think it's a shock for Eve to hear her son use this word in a sexual context. And I think she immediately thinks that he learned it from porn where because he certainly wouldn't have anybody modeling that kind of language for him in real life.
So, she's assuming her son watches porn. And then once he's out of the house, she starts watching a lot of porn. And would you describe the kind of porn she's especially interested in?
Yeah, well, she receives an anonymous text that applies a certain label to her, which you and I have agreed to say she's a sexy mom, a mom who is sexually desirable. People will know the acronym. And she's offended by it. And it's a dirty text. But at the same time, she realizes she's not really sure about what the term means. And she goes to look it up the way we do, and she realizes that it's not quite the old Mrs. Robinson stereotype. It's a more neutral and possibly even complimentary term, suggesting that you may be older, you may be a mom, but you're still desirable. And in the course of doing this, she's led to a website that basically consists of ordinary women in their 30s and 40s, sending in, or their husbands or their partners, sending in videos of them engaged in sex. So it's highly amateur, and it's just about people saying, hey, this is me. Here you can get a glimpse into my bedroom.
And she's surprised to find herself watching lesbian porn.
Yes, you know, she samples the menu, which is vast. And at a certain point, she settles on this lesbian porn as, you know, she's never thought of herself in this way, but this porn turns her on, and I think it leads her to sense that there are sexual possibilities in her world that she hasn't investigated yet.
In the sexy mother category of lesbian porn, you describe it as often beginning with a reluctant woman grumpily washing dishes or mopping the floor when the doorbell rings, and then a more confident woman arrives with a bottle of wine and a bit of exposed cleavage, and then the action begins. Did you watch a lot of this before writing the novel?
I watched enough to write the novel. Yeah, I did. And it was really interesting because, you know, people have different responses to porn, obviously, and some of it is, disturbing, and some of it is just too much. But I did find that I was especially interested by this category of porn that involved a kind of a seduction, because it was, I think, very different from, you know, the stereotypical male porn that would just sometimes just launch right in. You know, nobody wants any talking. But there was this sense that, you know, and I guess maybe this is a definition of a certain kind of female-friendly porn, that it was about two people connecting, and about, it was about seduction, actually, very clearly.
And then in contrasting that with her son, with Eve's son, he grows up in a boy culture where date rape doesn't seem like it's necessarily wrong to the boys. And if you're a guy who tries to intervene and stop date sexual harassment or date rape, you're going to be bullied for it. And it makes it very confusing for the boys, I think. And I'd like to know what you were thinking about when you were writing this character who is kind of subscribing to that kind of behavior and language and not really understanding what's wrong with it, even though he grows up in a family that wouldn't tolerate that kind of behavior.
Right, and he would say that it was wrong if you asked him about it. And I do think that I was really interested in the fact that, you know, we talk way more about consent than we did when I was in college.
When were you in college, by the way?
I graduated in 1983, and I think a whole sort of body of knowledge, you know, or just even the category of sexual harassment didn't fully exist. Like, I think I certainly knew students who'd had affairs with teachers, and that was sort of considered, you know, a little bit risky, but not beyond the pale. And you know, it just hadn't been codified as an offense at that point. It would soon change, but I will say, you know, we didn't speak as much about consent. We didn't speak as much about sexual boundaries. I think we were closer to the sexual revolution. It was right at the moment when AIDS started to really change people's sexual behaviors, but it is interesting to me that students now have all these workshops and sessions about consent, and yet it does seem like the problem. I don't know if it's getting better statistically. It's hard to say, but it does seem that these guys are somewhat immune to all of the teaching, or they arrive at college still expecting to have that party that they've been dreaming about.
The son in this novel, the boy who's going to college and is in college for a good deal of the book, he's oblivious to girls as equals, to girls as like full human beings, to girls as sexual partners as opposed to truly like sexual objects or appliances. And he's oblivious.
Yeah, and you know, when you read stories about sexual assault on campus and frat parties and everything, you just sort of, it does seem that there's some kind of stubborn culture of male entitlement that is somehow resistant to all of these pushes to change it. And you know, as a writer, I just thought that was, it would be really interesting to try and get into the mind of a kid like this. And, you know, I will say he's oblivious, but he does find himself attracted to a young woman who is very much on the other side of the divide. She's an activist. She sees herself as being very involved in social justice. They connect because they have autistic siblings, and he goes to a group that she leads to talk about the challenges of people with autistic siblings. But he goes there mainly because he's interested in her. And I will say, over the course of the book, in some ways she illuminates him. I don't know that she brings him into full consciousness. He's a very flawed and oblivious guy throughout. But she does challenge some of his assumptions, and college challenges some of his assumptions. He's resistant to those challenges, but I will say he gets some little bit of education over the course of the book.
Everyone in your book is having some kind of sexual identity or gender identity crisis. And you think that's one of the things that defines our time now, right?
Yeah, and I was writing the book at that moment when, you know, what had been a kind of fairly rarefied academic discussion of gender fluidity suddenly really entered the mainstream culture. And, you know, I was trying to situate my characters in that conversation where, you know, I think Eve, for instance, has a transgender professor in her gender and society class. And, you know, Brendan's sort of masculine view of the world is challenged by Amber, the young woman I was just talking about. So I really was trying to react in more or less real time to this cultural conversation that went from peripheral to central in what felt like record time.
So the mother, for instance, she's taking a course on gender and society at a community college, which has a lot of, you know, like adult students and students who are like working. So the students are assigned to write, quote, autobiographically and analytically about their own problematic experiences on the gender spectrum, with special emphasis on the social construction of identity, the persistence of sexism in a post-feminist culture, and the subversion of heteronormative discourse by LGBTQIA voices. That's not high academic language that I just read, but it's certainly not street language either. It's language that comes from, I think it's fair to say it comes from academia. Would you say that's true?
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. And
so what do you think about when you hear like the language to describe sexual identity, orientation, gender constructs, when you hear that language that originates in academia and is being used to describe really like personal, intimate, volatile subjects?
Yeah, you know, I think it is, it can be problematic. I mean, and to use another academic term, there is something alienating about academic language, and there's something maybe a little alienating about people suddenly being told, you know, you can't say that anymore. And, you know, a lot of what's emanating from academia is this sort of set of restrictions. You can't say this. And there's been, I think, a lot of resentment on the part of people who feel like, hey, I never signed on to that set of terminology. And sometimes they might, you know, I mean, it really is a good question as to whether or not we need new terms, or at least we need maybe to be a little more forgiving of people who aren't up to date on the most recent set of dictates about how this or that can be spoken of.
So did you come of age with feminism and with the gay rights movement?
So I went to college in 1979 from a working class high school. And so I really did have to have my consciousness raised. I came feeling probably the way my parents had. I would say, like, oh, there were no gay people in my high school. And sometimes I would make homophobic jokes. And I remember one day, I have a couple things happen. One, I had a wonderful professor who was gay, and I suddenly realized that I was an idiot for talking about things I didn't know. But then I also had another friend, you know, just say to me, like, why do you care? Why does it matter to you what somebody else does to, you know, in their bedroom? And I really was just, I had no answer for that. Why do I care? Because it made me feel superior, I guess. And I think there's a line in the book where Margot says, you know, feeling superior is its own reward. And I think, you know, all it took was just a few people asking me, why did I feel this way? Why did I think that way? And I, you know, I changed the way that a lot of Americans did over those years.
Another thing that I think is explored in your novel is the difference between the sex people are attracted to when watching pornography and what they want or feel comfortable with in real life. And for some people, that's the same. Even though it might be hard to get in real life what you've watched on porn. But for other people, it's really different. You can be turned on by something in porn and not feel at all comfortable with that in real life. Is that something you wanted to explore in the book?
You know, I think that I was just very interested in the way that porn encourages us to think about sex, which is it breaks it up into all these categories. And I think some of them are incredibly specific, and I guess, you know, would be, you know, their fetishes or whatever. But I think anybody who spent any time in that realm, you know, will just suddenly be exposed to something that you never even thought about, and that, or that you might have thought was, you know, not your cup of tea, and then sort of going, oh, that's more interesting than I thought, or, you know, I find that arousing or whatever. So that was definitely a part of porn that's really interesting, because I think that most of us, we don't know what other people do, but we don't want to do things that our partners are going to find shocking or embarrassing. But now suddenly we have all this information that sort of suggests that all these people are doing all these things, and maybe there's more things on heaven and earth than we dreamt of before. But that is also in the realm of fantasy sometimes, and in reality it's just not gonna work, or it's just not what it felt like on screen when somebody else was doing it.
So the mother, Eve, wanting some kind of adventure in her life with the new freedom that she has, like she misses her son, she's alone. So she's both lonely, but she also senses she has this freedom and she wants to use it. And one of the ways she uses it, as we've discussed, is like watching pornography. But when she goes out to dinner with a younger woman who works on her staff at the Senior Citizen Center, she makes a pass at her, which is rejected. And this is the first time she's ever even thought of the possibility of having a relationship with a woman. And when she's rejected, it's kind of devastating. It's like, okay, I tried freedom. Like, what did I think I was doing? Like, apparently I can't do that. Apparently I've made a terrible mistake. Now I'm just really embarrassed. It's inappropriate to, she thinks, as like the boss to have made a pass at someone who works for her. And she says, like, that's sexual harassment. Like, why did I do that? And she's just heartbroken and disappointed in herself, and also inhibited by the response that she's gotten. And I thought it was interesting for you as a male writer to try to really get deep into this woman's head while trying out for the first time a lesbian relationship.
Yeah, and I think... it really was coming from that sense that once she starts looking at porn, certain things in real life look different to her. So she's watching all this porn where a confident, experienced woman is seducing a woman who is sort of reluctant, I guess is the word that's used in the book. There's a confident one and a reluctant one. And she's having this wonderful dinner with her employee, and it's kind of flirtatious, and they're discussing sex and they're discussing gender, and she keeps feeling like the gravity of this porn scenario. It's like, oh, you know, which one of us is the confident one? Which one of us is the reluctant one? And somehow, I think this is really what the book is about. It's during this fall that most of the action takes place in, Eve is feeling her life becoming a kind of a porn scenario or a series of porn scenarios. And they do cause her to act in ways that she never would have acted before and ways that go against her principles. And one of the things that she says and that I do think is absolutely true is in porn, there's no such thing as sexual harassment. Anytime a kind of illicit situation is set up, it's so that the doctor can have sex with the patient, so the babysitter, you know, can get together with the parents who've come home. You know, there's no sexual harassment in porn. And so for a second, I think Eve mistakes her life for a porn scenario. And then when, cold water gets splashed on her, it's like she's waking from a dream. Like what was I doing? What was I thinking? And I am very interested in those moments when people do things that run contrary to their deepest principles, to their sense of right and wrong. Those are the moments, I think, when we find out who we really are.
And are you saying, too, that we sometimes confuse freedom with violating our own principles?
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? That's certainly how it is when we're kids, right? Where we're told you can't do this and you can't do that. And the minute you find yourself alone and unsupervised, those are the things you want to do. And so there is something in that kind of youthful rebellion against our parental strictures that I think, you know, can still affect you when you're an adult. I remember talking to a friend of mine when our kids had first left for college, and he's a little bit older and his kids had been gone. And I said, oh yeah, we're, you know, going to have an empty nest, you know, pretty soon. And he just looked at me with his sort of wearily and said, well, the pressure to have sex is enormous. You know, it's like the kids leaving was like before when your parents left, like you're suddenly free. There's nothing stopping you. And I do feel like Eve is in this moment when, you know, she's alone, she's on her own. And I think she does want to have a sexual life, and she's trying to figure out how to make that happen.
So I want to take a turn in the conversation to the senior citizen center that Eve runs. And she has to call people sometimes to say, your father is really misbehaving. You know, just to call one guy and say, like, you have to come get your father. He can't work here anymore. He's exposed himself and said terrible things in the women's room. And the women, the seniors who were in the bathroom, were on the verge of calling the police. So, like, this has got to stop. Did you ever get one of those? I don't know if your parents have ever been in an assisted living facility or a nursing home or a senior center where you've ever gotten a call like that?
I have not had that happen personally, but when my kids were younger, I remember that, you know, the local paper had a story about the father of a woman who was, you know, who I'd see in the schoolyard, and it sounded like he had been exposing himself, and I thought, oh, this is terrible. Her father's a sex offender. And then, you know, she was just sort of explaining that her father has dementia and was just, you know, he just didn't know what he was doing. And in the course of writing the book, I did speak to a woman who runs a senior center, and she was telling me that was, you know, one of the saddest parts of the job was just having often to be the one to break the news to say to people, an elderly parent needs to be in assisted living. They're no longer able to act appropriately. And it really is, you know, a kind of a, you know, almost like the flip side of preschool, right? You can't go to preschool unless you're, you know, potty trained, and you can't stay at the senior center if you are incontinent.
You write from multiple perspectives in the book. There are chapters from the perspective of the mother, chapters from the perspective of the son, chapters from the perspective of the woman who's the employee at the senior center and who the mother tries to have an affair with. Why did you want to write from multiple perspectives?
Well, the truth is with this book that I actually didn't. My original thought was that I was going to write a very short, tight book about a woman who goes into a kind of a weird sexual fugue state when she's after her son leaves for college, and so the Eve story was going to be the entire story, and I wrote that the first chapter of the book, but her son had become a vivid character in that, and I suddenly was like, I want to know what he's doing, what's happening with him, and I realized that the counterpoint of the two of them on these journeys of, you know, transformation was really interesting. And then, you know, this is just how I write now. I think Eve's employee is, I know she's going to be part of a romantic story, and so I want to know who she is. So, let's spend a chapter with her. And I spend chapters with Margot, Eve's professor. There's a boy named Julian in Eve's class who's had some bad experiences with Eve's son, and we spend some time with him. I don't know. I guess that it's just become my way of writing, is that a single point of view just doesn't seem enough for me in a novel. I've read great novels that have just a single point of view, but I feel like I need to kind of get inside as many characters as I can.
Since you write about turning points in people's lives, what was a big turning point in your life?
Well, I do have to say that going to college was, going to college at Yale specifically after growing up where I did in New Jersey. At the time, I was really adamant with myself that I was not going to let this snobby Ivy League world change who I was, and that I could go there, kind of take what it had to offer, and emerge kind of unscathed. And what I discovered, and I really tried that. I had a girlfriend at home. I came home a lot on weekends. I always came home for the summers. I always had blue-collar jobs during those summers. But at a certain point in my late 20s, I suddenly realized, you know, I don't eat the same food as my parents anymore. I don't watch the same TV shows as them. I don't read the same books. I feel like there's this distance sometimes between me and older friends. I think that it's just in spite of all of my determination, I had been really transformed by the experience of going to this, elite Ivy League college at that particular point in my life.
How did your parents and how did your old friends react to the changed version of you? Did your parents say, "What happened to you? You're not our son anymore"?
No, you know, my parents were great about it. I think especially my mom, she was the one who really encouraged my siblings and me to go to the best schools we possibly could. And I think she sort of accepted that that transformation. I remember occasionally, my father has been dead for the past 15 years, but I do remember a few times when I was sort of just mocking some TV show he was watching. And I remember, and I thought it was just a dumb show. It was, I can't even remember what it was. And I remember that he turned to me with a really, He was both irritated and wounded, I think, by the fact that I was looking down on the show that he was watching. And you know, I still actually feel bad about that. And you know, that's the part of the transformation in my own life that I'm not crazy about. You know, the sense that the country really is divided by class, and, you know, by virtue of going to an Ivy League school, I did like sort of jump social classes, and it's real. You know, there is a kind of condescension that can come with that I, you know, have to really fight in myself.
Well, Tom Perata, thanks so much for talking with us again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Tom Perata speaking with Terry Gross, recorded last July. Perata's new novel, Mrs. Fletcher, is now out in paperback.